What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
I was 3 when I was kidnapped, any age. The day must have been a Saturday or a Sunday, because when my grandmother and I stepped from the fabric store, we were shocked at how dark the day had become. So it must have been midday, me not in school. Unless it was a summer day. Usually whenever we shopped for fabric store things, whenever my grandmother shopped for fabric store things, we went to a Michaels and a strip mall down Highway 183, just far enough for the strip mall to seem alien, impossible to get home if I were ever left there. But on this day, we had gone to a fabric store I had never seen before, its name a blank stucco edifice to me now. Am I misremembering it?
That's Shane McCrae, award-winning poet and author of the recent book, Pulling the Chariot of the Sun, a memoir of a kidnapping. Shane's is a story about, yes, being kidnapped by his white grandparents to keep him away from his black father. But at its heart, it's about the attempt to recover memory, to put together the many blank or missing pieces that were kept from him, to assemble a life and a whole, complete self. I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is Family Secrets, the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves.
I suppose I could start with Round Rock, Texas, which is where I lived from the age of almost 4 until the age of 10 or 11. I lived in a 3-bedroom house that was made of brick, and the bricks were painted a very light yellow. The neighborhood that I lived in was a suburban neighborhood, but far away from anything that one might call a city center. There was like a kind of strip mallish area, too far away to walk to or anything like that, but that was the closest to a kind of urban center near where I lived. And so there were just a bunch of houses across the street from me. There was the elementary school that I ended up going to. I think that sidewalks are now there, but when I lived there, there weren't any sidewalks. There was a creek that I felt sort of separated the part of the neighborhood in which I lived from the rest of the neighborhood. The rest of the neighborhood beyond this creek was a lot larger than the part in which I lived. And the creek, as far as I know, doesn't exist anymore. I saw my old neighborhood about 10 years ago, and where the creek was, it seemed like it had all been covered with cement. And so there's still a channel, I guess, for water. But when I lived there, there was a creek with sort of these natural little rock islands in it, and a lot of catfish and snakes, poisonous snakes. You could kind of see the elementary school from my house. Behind the elementary school was, I don't really know the history of this space, but it looked kind of like a ruin of a very small settlement. There were a few houses in this kind of large warehousey space, and it was really very, very strange. You accessed it by kind of going through a little kind of foresty area, a large patch of which somehow was bamboo. And on the other side of this bamboo area were a few ruined houses. They looked as if they had been torn up, like a storm had gone through them, but there were still remnants, things that would indicate that people had lived there, like bits of furniture, things like that. But they must have been abandoned or whatever it was that happened to them some years before my family moved into that area.
Did that exert a pull on you at all, you know, that sort of abandoned area?
Visiting that space is one of the few relatively clear memories that I have of my childhood. But now when I think about it, it sounds like a sort of impossible space. Like, how could it have been real? How could I have ever gone there? Even though I feel really confident that I went there, I also doubt the possibility of it even existing. But it did exert a pull on me. I liked to explore a lot when I was a small child.
And tell me who you lived in the yellow house with.
My maternal grandparents, my grandmother, who was my mother's biological mother, and my grandfather, who had adopted my mother when my mother was, I believe, 13 years old.
So Shane is living with his grandparents. He refers to them as mom and dad, even though on some level he's aware that they're his grandparents. And when his mom, a young woman who had him at just 18 years old, comes to visit, he calls her by her first name, Denise.
When my mother came to visit me, I don't think there's any way for me to know whether she felt like my mother, because I wouldn't know what it feels like. She's the only model that I would have. And so, particularly as a child, I guess maybe in some ways not, just because the person that I called, referred to as my mother, was my grandmother. But I was aware that my mother was my mother. And so in a kind of abstract way, I felt a very strong connection to her insofar as she was my mother and I was aware of it. I lived with her up until I was about 4, I guess, most of the time.
You describe at one point sitting by the window, you know, when you knew she was going to be coming. And it struck me the way that you described that, that there was a kind of combination of excitement and a kind of longing.
Sure.
So what was the story that you grew up being told by your maternal grandparents about your father and about why you were living with them, you know, away from your family?
So my grandparents told me that the reason that I didn't live with my father, well, really the reason I didn't see him, didn't really know him, was that he didn't want me. And also that even if I were interested in seeing him, it kind of didn't matter because they told me that he lived in Brazil and he had a whole new family, other children now, and that he just wouldn't be interested in seeing me anyway. And they told me that I had started to live with them when I was 18 months old, and that they had essentially taken me in as a favor to my mother, because she felt like she couldn't take care of me. And since my father was out of the picture, whatever his opinions about whether he could take care of me, those were irrelevant. The general sense that I was supposed to have was that my father's family were sort of disreputable, criminal even. My grandparents had told me the story that one of my relatives on my father's side had, 1 year when I was very little, I guess it must have been 1 year old, had stolen all of my Christmas presents. And I think they told me that story just to sort of reinforce the idea that I shouldn't even want to have anything to do with my father's side of the family, and I was better off not knowing them. I should also say that, I mean, you know, as a small child, my sense of how biology worked was, with regard to parents and children, really vague. But I was aware of my father's blackness, and I was aware that my father's blackness had something to do with my own identity, something very significant.
And did you have a sense that that was an issue for your grandparents?
Yeah, my grandparents were very clear about not liking not white people to various degrees. My grandfather was a self-identified Republican. My grandmother was a self-identified Democrat, but they could agree that not white people were not good. That was what they wanted to communicate in various ways. My grandmother was more subtle than my grandfather was.
But that was a point of agreement for them.
Yes.
All the years that Shane lives with his grandparents, he always sleeps with his lights on. Something's going on internally, something that doesn't feel quite right. Kids always know, don't we, when something's amiss, even though we can't quite identify it. One day in school, where Shane has skipped a grade, so he's 5 or 6 years old and already in second grade, he draws a swastika on a white t-shirt with a black magic marker. Shane has seen swastikas in books about World War II in his grandparents' house, where they admire the Nazi military effort. So he has no idea he's doing something that people will find troubling. And the principal sends him home.
My grandmother in particular felt that that was an abuse of authority to send me home for drawing swastikas all over my shirt, which it hadn't occurred to me because I didn't know anything about the history at all. It hadn't occurred to me that that was a sort of offensive thing to do. I had no idea. When I was in elementary school, when I was asked about my father, I would just say that I didn't have one. I felt really strongly, actually, like I just didn't. Whereas by the time I got to middle school, I started asserting that I hated him. I didn't know him, obviously, but nonetheless, if I were asked about him, that's what I would say.
And Shane, where was the hate coming from?
That he was not interested in me. And so I hated him for that, or at least thought I did.
Meanwhile, there's other hateful behavior within the wall of Shane's grandparents' home. His grandfather is violent toward him. And when Denise comes to visit, she sometimes asks if he wants to come live with her instead.
Whenever my mother would ask me whether I wanted to live with her, it was very uncomfortable because I was aware that she was my mother and that I was supposed to feel a particular way. And, you know, I did love her. I didn't want to hurt her feelings. But I also sort of thought of my grandmother as my mother, and I didn't want to leave my grandparents. And I've often wondered, you know, why did I want to stay so desperately with these abusive people? And it wasn't until recently that I was sort of finally able to make sense of it, thinking about, you know, well, along with so many other things, this is almost certainly a consequence of being kidnapped, that I didn't want any sort of major change in my living arrangement, that my anxiety about that, even though I couldn't articulate it, was incredibly high. I was very, very anxious. And also always worried that I was going to be forced from the particular living arrangement that I had. And so it was always extremely stressful. I think I understand why my mother wanted me to be aware that I could live with her if I wanted to, but it was always an extremely stressful interaction to me.
But during these exchanges with his mom, she never tells him that she too had been beaten by her father when she was younger, which makes it even more striking that she also never asks Shane whether his grandfather is also abusing him.
It's something that I guess, to some extent, I still kind of can't really understand, unless I hold in my mind that she was very desperate to please my grandfather. There's only so much I can read into her own motives, but I think it partly has to do with he adopted her when she was 13, but he had been living with her for, by that time, like 8 years or something, and he had told her from the beginning that if she was quote-unquote good, he would adopt her when she was 13. And so kind of loading her with worry about living up to some sort of idea of goodness so that she could have a father. Because, you know, my grandmother had kidnapped my mother from my mother's father when my mother was two, had just taken my mother and not told him where they were going. And my mother didn't see him again until she was about 60 when she found him. And so I think that there was a lot of desire for a father and a lot of worry that she would be rejected by her father. And so I think that when she allowed my grandparents to take me, she couldn't allow herself to believe that it wouldn't be a safe place for me, for a couple of reasons that were sort of reinforcing each other. Because she maybe felt like she couldn't take care of me herself, but she also felt like, as I said, she really wanted to please my grandfather.
We'll be right back.
Have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV, and be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
At age 13, Shane does ultimately move in with his mother. In his adolescence, he's beginning to stand up to his grandfather, and as a result, their relationship has become even more violent, so much so that Shane's memories of the beatings have receded into parts of his mind he still cannot fully access. These memories are blocked in ways that both cost and protect him. He does remember, however, in broad, hazy strokes, moving in with his mom.
Being at my mother's house is sort of like an island. Like, it's a visible island where I can see days and I can see place and I can see arriving, you know, but it's surrounded by blackness. Like, there's no before and there's no after. I know what it was like, you know, like physically, but I don't have any memory of the time leading up to being with my mother. I just suddenly remember being there. But I feel like I remember a long stretch of being there. And then I leave and I don't remember again.
I mean, that's such an interesting image. And I wondered, I mean, do you think that you felt briefly while you were there a certain kind of safety that you hadn't felt before? Like, did you feel safer?
I guess I must have felt safer at my mother's house, but I don't know that I recall a feeling of safety. I recall a degree of anxiety, a lot of worry. It was just different from my grandparents' house. I was, I think in some ways, really different there, but I was only there for a few months. But in a lot of ways, I guess, actually, my life was different, and I think I was different.
Of course, Denise's life is different during this time, too. She's never had a child under her roof. She's never really had this experience of being a mother. It's a struggle for her, and it turns out she isn't capable of taking care of Shane. She tells him that he'll have to go back to live with his grandparents. But before he goes, she tells him something else, the truth about what happened when he was 3 years old, when he was kidnapped.
So before I left my mother to return to my grandparents was when my mother told me that my grandparents had taken me from my father without telling my father where they were taking me. Up until this point, it was my understanding that my father just wasn't interested in me at all. And so learning this was a shock. But because my grandparents had so effectively raised me to have no interest in my father, and because I didn't have any kind of memory of my time with him, and because I didn't have any understanding even of the timeline, you know, I didn't know that I was almost 4 years old when my grandparents took me. I thought I was 18 months old. And because there were, I assume because there's such a huge conflict between reality and the story, my memory of it also, I mean, because I think the kidnapping itself is such a traumatic event, that memory is just, it's all gone. I mean, I did know that at this point I had already decided that I didn't hate my father, but I didn't know what to do with that, you know, because I didn't have any contact with him still. And so hating him or not hating him in a sense is sort of, it's not exactly irrelevant, but it's not, what is its practical effect? I don't think that I stopped hating him for any particular reason. I think it was just getting a little bit older. I mean, I wasn't, you know, still a child, but maybe sort of beginning to think for myself a little bit helped me to get beyond the point where I felt like hating my father was sort of necessary.
Shane's grandparents are in California at this point, and he does end up moving back in with them. He has nowhere else to go. In the throes of so much instability, Shane's early teenage years are defined by depression and flux. When he's 14, his grandmother decides to leave his grandfather, so she and Shane move back to Salem, Oregon, back where it all began. During this time, Shane becomes increasingly curious about his father. He now has the information his mother told him, as well as his father's name, Stanley, or perhaps it's Stan Lee. What he doesn't know is where this man is. The stories about Brazil suddenly don't sit right. Shane begins to wonder if perhaps his father is right here in Salem.
I was with some friends, and we were skating in an apartment complex and had been skating for some time. And for whatever reason, at that moment, I felt like I should look up my father. I want to know if he's still here. So I, with my friends, knocked on a stranger's door. This would have been, I guess, probably 1992. And it's a somewhat unusual thing to do. It's a weird thing to do now, maybe. But in 1992, it wasn't completely bizarre, you know, because there weren't cell phones, etc. And so I knocked on a stranger's door and asked if I could use her phone book. She said yes. So I, you know, opened up the white pages. I flipped around until I got to the M's. And I saw an S. McCrae. And then I closed the book. And that was sort of it. I didn't write down his number or anything. But from that moment, I was aware that there was at least somebody who could be my father, because same initial, same last name, you know, Salem, it's not a huge city. So that there was somebody who could have been him in the town. I don't think that I sat around with that information for very long before I tried to get in touch with him. I think it might have only been a few days. As I remember it, I called his number. This was at my house where I live with my grandmother. I called my father's number and my stepmother, Candace, answered. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know who she was. And I asked if he was there, and I didn't know his name exactly, you know. And so I asked if Stan Lee was there, but I said it, Stan Lee McRae, I said it in a way that I hoped would cover the possibilities that either his name was Stanley or Stan, middle name Lee. And I tried to say it in a way that would do both. And so I recall my stepmother, Candace, saying, hold on a minute, and putting the phone down and getting my father and talking with him. My father has a different memory of it, that he wasn't at home at the time, and that so that we talked later. I still feel like my version of it is what happened, but you know, I have to at least acknowledge that he remembers it differently. And that was it. He came to see me that night and then drove me around Salem, introducing me to relatives. The McRae family is a pretty big and well-known family in Salem. And so I knew who the McRaes were, which is, I guess, part of the reason that I thought he would might very well still be around. And so he kind of drove me around introducing me to them. And it was a sort of bewildering time. I learned during the time that I was a kind of spectral presence in their lives and had been my whole life. Folks had talked about me. I want to say that it felt like, in some ways, being a ghost, like I was inhabiting an idea of myself that had come before me. But of course, I don't know what it's like to be a ghost. But that's how I would describe it, that I was walking around in the place of a previous version of myself. And it was just very self-dislocating and also self-maybe renewing, maybe affirming. It was a strange day.
Shane imagines a parallel life, a life in which he hadn't been kidnapped, in which he would have grown up in Salem and been one of the McRaes and part of this big family. And then all these years later, he's a late teenager and something has been restored. But in something being restored, what's been taken away is thrown into even starker relief.
I don't want to describe it in a way that's too melodramatic, but you can never really, at least I can never, I think, really be healed if one conceives of healing as, you know, having a sense of wholeness in relation to the family that I didn't grow up with and in relation to the self I could have been. I am instead very, very aware of all of these lives that might be my actual life and that might be, you know, have something to do with my biological information, etc. And I'm aware that I can't know any of them for sure. I don't really know who I am, and I can't really know who I am. And partly that's the result of an effort on the part of my grandparents to ensure that I couldn't know. Partly that's because they had their own secrets that they were trying to hide from me and my mother, like my grandmother being married 5 times. I remember having a conversation with my mother some time after my grandmother died, where my grandmother had somehow raised me with an awareness, really when I was a teenager, I started to get the awareness of how many times she had been married. And I had a number that was one more than the number that my mother had. And it turned out my number was also not all of them. So that neither of us had the complete picture, but our pictures were different from each other's.
You write that your father says to you in one of your early conversations that part of why he was still in Salem was because he always wanted you to be able to find him. It was sort of the opposite, if such a thing can be. It was a kind of 180 degrees from the story that you had been fed by your grandparents who kidnapped you. You describe him as someone very kind and very much not angry. And it seems like he was described in a very different way to you, presented as a very different kind of person.
Yeah, my father is one of the calmest people that I know and doesn't seem to hold any grudges. Certainly doesn't seem to hold any grudges in any way having to do with me being kidnapped. I think that it was something that he had to kind of live with and work through for a really long time before we reconnected, before I found him. My understanding of it is he was really thoughtful about it, sort of from the beginning, beyond the sort of visceral, very intense feelings that he and any parent would have. He also was thinking about it. And being aware of that, one of the reasons that he didn't leave Salem is he wanted me to be able to find him. I mean, that means a lot to me, and it meant a lot to me at the time. One of the things, maybe the chief thing, beyond not having a real memory of my childhood and not really having a childhood in my memory, is that I don't have, with regard to my parents, I think, I have a really difficult time accessing or sort of experiencing my feelings, you know? And it feels like, ironically, I suppose, my relationship with my feelings feels like. One of the reasons that I have such difficulty accessing my feelings is I'm trying to protect myself from something. It's the same mechanism that, you know, results in me having blocked so many memories. It's the same kind of desire to protect myself. So when I think about being told, you know, that he hadn't left because he was hoping I could find him, of course that fills me with emotion, but it fills me with emotion in the way that, like, if you're watching a glass being filled with a liquid, I am aware, I can see it. I can see the being filled with emotion happening, as opposed to I am in the glass or I am the glass, you know? There's something about, you know, the inability to be the glass, you know, to just have to watch it happening, that I feel as a impoverishment. I would like to be able to experience those emotions in a more immediate way, but I also feel in a sort of abstract, vague way that I wouldn't be able to handle them. I wouldn't know what to do with them. And so even though I'm in my late 40s, I'm still at this stage with regard to all this information at which I have barely begun to sort of incorporate it into my life, to sort of figure out how to have some control over it or have some healthiness in relation to it. I was going to say to heal, but I think that's not right. I don't think that's the right word. I think there are ways in which I'm lucky that I got so good at blocking out memories, about blocking out sort of painful things, insofar as if I'm going to have this big, enormous mess in the middle of my life, it's good that I can live without it dominating every moment of my life. On the other hand, I am aware that it would probably be a good thing to someday get to the other side of it, but I don't know how. So when I think about things like that, things like what my father said, it's very emotional, but I'm also aware of how emotional it is in a way that sort of interferes with the full experience of the thing, I think.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And yet, at the same time, you have been able to create and build a family and have a happy relationship with a partner and three kids. That strikes me as an extraordinary thing. Like, maybe all of this is compartmentalized, but the love isn't compartmentalized.
That's true.
Here's Shane reading one last passage from Pulling the Chariot of the Sun.
My father is picking up the phone. Then his voice, hello, that I hadn't heard for 13 years, immediately like no other person's voice, an accent I couldn't place, music from somewhere I didn't know anymore, wavering in each syllable. Even a simple word like hello, loosened by music, made difficult to understand, though I knew he had said hello, though I had heard only music, and I asked him his name.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio. Molly Zakur is the story editor, and Dylan Fagan is the executive producer. If you have a family secret you'd like to share, please leave us a voicemail, and your story could appear on an upcoming episode. Our number is 1-888-SECRET-0. That's the number 0. You can also find me on Instagram at Danny Writer. And if you'd like to know more about the story that inspired this podcast, check out my memoir, Inheritance.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco-Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. And right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.